Chapter 14. Alan Richman is a Douchebag. The intersection where chefs, writers, restaurant reviewers, publicists, and journalists meet has always been a swamp, an ethical quagmire where the lines between right and wrong are by unarticulated consensus kept deliberately permeable. It's like a never-ending hillbilly joke. We've all fucked each other's sisters. Everybody in the family is aware of it, but we delicately avoid the subject. The New York Times struggles mightily to remain above the orgy of pride, vanity, greed, gluttony, and other sinful behaviors around it, traditionally by keeping its critic as anonymous as possible. False identities, wigs, and other disguises are employed in an effort to keep their writer from being recognized. It doesn't always work, of course. Any restaurant with serious four-star aspirations always has someone on staff who can pick out Frank Bruni or Sam Sifton from across a crowded room. To what degree that helps, however, is debatable. To the Times' credit, I've never heard of anyone reaching a full-time reviewer, influencing the review through favors, special access, or things of value. From what I've heard, lavishing extra attention on them is risky and not necessarily rewarding. Knowing the Times guy by sight is useful mostly for making extra sure you don't fuck up, rather than providing you with a real edge. Those chef players who do dare to send extras are very careful to do the same for all the surrounding tables as well. Anonymity does not provide 100% protection from special treatment. But it's an extra layer, an added degree of difficulty, the ethical version of a wetsuit or hazmat garment, keeping the Times man or woman safe from contamination in the primordial soup of free food, bodily fluids, and slow-festering morals they must swim in. Journalists who write about food and chefs are in the business of providing punchy, entertaining prose, hopefully with a good human interest story attached, and some good quotes. More important, they want and need an angle or perspective different from what every other food or dining writer is doing. They would greatly prefer it if a website or food blogger has not already comprehensively covered the same subject. This is, to be fair, extraordinarily difficult. People who write professionally about food, to the exclusion of all other topics, are painfully aware of the limitations of the form. There are only so many ways to describe a slow-roasted pork belly before you run into the word unctuous again. Trying to conjure a descriptive for salad must be like one's 10th year writing penthouse letters. The words crunchy, zing, tart, and rich are as bad as poon, cooter, coos, and snatch when scrolling across the brain in predictable, dreary procession. Worse, while your editor has just asked for an overview of Queens Ethnic in a week, some lonely food nerd has been methodically eating his way, block by block, across the entire borough and blogging about it for years. Pity, too, the poor chefs. One of their new jobs in this brave new world of dining is co-opting, corrupting, and otherwise compromising food writers whenever possible. The care and feeding of the Fourth Estate and their bastard offspring, food bloggers, has become an important skill set for any chef looking to hit the big time. It's no longer enough to cook well to be able to run a kitchen. You have to be able to identify and evaluate all the people who might hurt you, and as best as possible, neutralize them ahead of time. One memorably bad review can punch a hole in a restaurant's painstakingly acquired reputation, letting the air out of one's public profile in a way that's often hard to put back. One snarky website, early in a restaurant's life, can hobble it in ways that might well prove fatal in the long run. When you are repeatedly made to look ridiculous, lowbrow, or déclassé on Grub Street or Eater, it's very hard to get your mojo back, as operators like Jeffrey Chodoro have found to their displeasure. Nowadays, the professional snarkologist will confidently apply that a Chodoro place will surely suck even before it opens. In a business where something as nebulous and unmeasurable as buzz is seen as a vital factor for the bottom line, everybody with a keyboard is a potential enemy. But traditionally, at least, turning a journo is usually a pretty simple matter. Just feed them for free. You'll never have to remind them about it later, believe me. They'll remember. It's like giving a bent cop a Christmas turkey. They may not be able to help you directly, but they'll at least make an effort to not hurt you. And if you can make a journalist or a webmaster your special friend, you have a powerful ally. In addition to singing your praise early and often from the rooftops, they can act as your proxy, shouting down those who might question your magnificence. Every time a restaurant opens, the joint's PR firm sits down with the chef and the owner and starts running down the list of usual suspects, wanting to know who are the friendlies and who are not. Most restaurants have one version or another of the same list. They are all, presumably, the sort of people who want to come to a special pre-opening tasting at your restaurant. They will not be reviewing you yet, which lets them off the ethical hook, so to speak. Few are the people who, when passing the smiling woman with a clipboard from the restaurant's PR agency, want to find themselves off that list the next time a restaurant opens, particularly if it's a high-end, high-prestige operator or if there's a hotshot chef involved. The thinking is, okay, I hate this place, but if I take too ferocious a dump on it, I won't be welcome at the next place, which might be really good. Or, I really enjoy being able to get a table on short notice at X, an existing hard-to-get-into fine dining restaurant. I don't want to fuck that up. When it comes to yours truly, I confess to being hopelessly mobbed up. While I do not claim to review restaurants or even write about them for magazines much anymore, I cannot be trusted or relied on to give readers anywhere near the truth, the whole truth, or anything like it. I've been swimming in those blood-warm waters for a long time now. I'm friends with a lot of chefs. Others whom I'm not friends with, I often identify with or respect to a degree that would prevent me from being frank with a reader or anyone outside the business. After all those years inside the business, I'm still too sympathetic to anybody who works hard in the kitchen to be a trustworthy reviewer. I'm 3 degrees separated from a lot of chefs in this world. I get a lot of meals comped. If I were to walk into one of Mario Batali's places, for instance, and see something unspeakable going on in the kitchen, animal sacrifice or satanic rituals or something unhygienic or deeply disturbing, I'd never write about it. I've been on both sides of the fence. Eager chef looking to make friends out of journos or bloggers, and a bent, compromised writer whose interests are way too commingled with his subjects for him to ever be truly trusted. But for all the awful things I've seen and done, I've never stooped to, well, let's begin at the beginning, with a food writer, critic, and journalist who could, on balance, be considered among the very best, a lion among the trolls, an excellent writer of sentences, with remarkably good taste in restaurants, a refined palate, and decades of experience. But I digress. Let's get to the action. I called Alan Richman a douchebag. So Richman, respected elder statesman of restaurant criticism, winner of an armload of James Beard Awards, and writer-reviewer for GQ, responded in keeping with his position as the dean of food journalism and in the time-honored tradition of his craft. He reviewed the restaurant I worked at. Actually, it was somewhat worse than that. He reviewed the restaurant I used to work at. Though he acknowledged by paragraph 2 of the gleeful takedown that followed that he knew I hadn't worked at Leal in nearly a decade, he forged on, absolutely savaging everything from upholstery to lighting, service, and food. He did mention a dessert favorably, attributing its lack of awfulness to the probability that I had not contaminated it. It was a thorough, critical disembowelment. The words grubby, acrid, flavorless, surly, greasy, and inedible all making appearances in the same few paragraphs. It's the customary practice of major media to devote their very limited restaurant review space to 3 categories of restaurant. 1, new endeavors brought to us by already critically acclaimed chefs. 2, the rarer discovery of a new chef's debut effort. Or 3, a change of guard or concept at a well-known, already well-reviewed restaurant. Leal did not, by any stretch of the imagination, meet any of these criteria. At no time did Richman suggest why he might be reviewing his 16-year-old restaurant of limited aspirations. Whatever its virtues, Leal was not hot or particularly relevant to today's trends. The menu certainly hadn't changed in years, and there had been no change in chefs. Nor did he mention anywhere in his scorching review what was surely the most cogent point, that only weeks earlier I'd repeatedly called him a douchebag. In fact, I'd nominated him for Douchebag of the Year in front of a hooting audience of half-drunk foodies at the South Beach Food and Wine Festival, an award Richmond won handily, I might add. The award, only one of many honors handed out in a silly, half-assed, faux ceremony, presenters wore shorts and flip-flops, was widely reported on the internet. And I guess Richmond's feelings were hurt. Enough so that he was inspired to remove his bathrobe, brush the cat hair off his jacket, and head into Manhattan to review, after all these years, Leal, a steak frite joint. Now, let me ask you a question. If I were to call you, say, an asshole, you'd probably call me an asshole right back. Or maybe you'd go me one better. You'd call me a fucking asshole. Or better yet, get really personal. A loud, egotistical, one-note asshole who's been cruising on the reputation of one obnoxious, over-testosterone book for way too long and who should just shut the fuck up. This would be entirely fair and appropriate, one would think. I call you a schoolyard name, you respond in kind. You acknowledge the insult and reply with a pithy riposte. But not Richmond. He is, after all, an impeccably credentialed journalist, critic, educator, and arbiter of taste. Not for him a public pissing contest with some semi-educated journeyman who called him a dirty name. No. What this utterly bent, gutless punk does, metaphorically speaking, is track down my old girlfriend from junior high, whom I haven't seen in years, sneak up behind her, and deliver a vicious sucker punch. That'll teach me, right? It's the old I can't hurt you, but I can surely hurt someone you love strategy, made more egregious and pathetic by the simple fact that Richmond, douchebag or not, is a fairly erudite guy, fully trained in the manly art of the insult. He could have nailed me directly, an option whose possibilities are only hinted at in his review when he makes a most excellent and painfully funny comparison of me to beefy direct-to-video action star Steven Seagal. That was what you'd call a palpable hit. That hurt. In order to better understand Richmond's inappropriate and unethical cold-cocking of my blameless former comrades, you need to go back to examine what moved me to accuse this beloved titan of food journalism of epic douchebaggery in the first place, and ponder if even that description is adequate. Was it perhaps part of a larger pattern of behavior? A year after the worst natural disaster in the history of the United States, New Orleans was a city still on its knees. 1,836 people dead, $100 billion in damages, untold thousands of its citizens dispersed, dislocated, traumatized, lifetimes of accumulated possessions, photographs, mementos gone forever. Worse still, there was the realization by the residents of an entire major American city that their government, when push came to shove, just didn't give a fuck about them. The city was still in shock. Whole neighborhoods stood empty. One fully functioning hospital. And the restaurant industry, which had been among the first to return after the flooding and was desperately trying to hold on to its staffs, was down 40% in business or more. And that is when Alan Richmond comes along, having decided in his wisdom that now is the time for a snarky reevaluation of the New Orleans dining scene. He'd already determined that New Orleans pretty much deserved what it got. Inspired, perhaps, by the Tyson defense team, he launches right away into a key component of his argument. That the bitch was asking for it. Quote, "It was never the best idea building a subterranean city on a defenseless coastline. Residents could have responded to that miscalculation in any number of conscientious ways. But they chose endless revelry, becoming a festival of narcissism, indolence, and corruption. Tragedy could not have come to a place more incapable of dealing with it," unquote. He suggests that bad character and loose morals have led directly to what happened to New Orleans. "For one thing, they like food too much," he goes on to say. This from a man who for decades has made a living shoving food into his crumb-flecked maw, then writing about it in a way calculated to make us feel like we should care. And we did care. So it's monstrously disingenuous of Richmond to now claim that perhaps we care too much. Quote, "It might sound harmless for a civilization to focus on food, but it's enormously indulgent. Name a society that cherishes tasting menus, and I'll show you a people too portly to mount up and repel invaders," unquote. Maybe I'm reading too much into this, but Here is Richmond really saying if only these fat fucks had laid off the dessert cart, they could have outrun the flood? Having blamed the victims for the carnage, a direct result he proposes of their immoral and ungodly behavior, he seems to depict Katrina and the perfect storm of incompetence and neglect that followed as some kind of divine retribution, a punishment for libertinism. Not yet done, he goes on to question if the food was ever any good in the first place, if New Orleans' famous Creole cuisine, or Creoles themselves for that matter, ever existed. Not only is New Orleans not worth visiting now, but perhaps it sucked all along. Quote, supposedly Creoles can be found in and around New Orleans. I have never met one, and suspect they are a fairy folk, like leprechauns, rather than an indigenous race. The idea that you might today eat an authentic Creole dish is a fantasy, unquote. What the fuck does authentic mean anyway? Creole, by definition, is a cuisine and a culture undergoing slow but constant change since its beginnings, a result of a gradual, natural fusion, like Singaporean or Malaysian flavors and ingredients changing along with who's making babies with whom and for how long. The term authentic, as Richmond surely knows, whether discussing Indian curries or Brazilian feijoada, is essentially meaningless. Authentic when? Authentic to whom? But it sounds good and wise, doesn't it? In the days following Katrina, Chef Donald Link of the restaurant Herb Saint was one of the very first business owners to return to the city. The floodwaters still barely receded to slop out the ruins of his existing restaurant and to rather heroically and against all odds open a new one. He staffed his place with anyone he could find, took on volunteers, and served food, whatever he could, in the streets, sending a timely and important message that New Orleans was still alive and worth returning to. Richmond chose his restaurant to trash. I should mention that I visited New Orleans a year after Richmond's article. It was a city still struggling to get up off its knees. The vast dining rooms and banquet spaces of Antoine's, the beloved institution in the French Quarter, were mostly empty. And yet the restaurant soldiered on with nearly a full staff, unwilling to fire people who'd worked for the company for decades. Everyone I spoke to, at one point or another, would still tear up and start to cry, remembering lost friends, lost neighborhoods, whole lives swept away. It seems sometimes like all New Orleans had had a collective nervous breakdown, their psyches shattered by first the disaster itself, and then later by a pervasive sense of betrayal. How could a country, their country, have let this happen? Their neighbors left to huddle like cattle in a fetid, reeking stadium, or bloat and rot, day after day in full view of the world. It's the kind of scenario, the kind of special circumstances one would think, or even the most hardened journalist would ask himself, do I really want to kick them when they're down? Richmond was not reporting on Watergate, after all. He wasn't uncovering a secret Iranian nuclear program. He was writing an overview of restaurants, about a restaurant town that survives largely on its service economy. At its lowest, most vulnerable point, right after a disaster unprecedented in American history. And not for the Washington Post either, mind you. For a magazine about ties and grooming accessories and choosing the right pair of slacks. But no matter. The truth must be served. Alan Richmond knows what authentic Creole cuisine means, and he damn sure wants you to know it. This alone was surely reason enough to qualify as a finalist for Douchebag of the Year. But there was also this, another column, Richmond's Restaurant Commandments, in which he imperiously, if rather wittily, laid out a compendium of things which he found annoying and which those restaurants hoping to stay in his good graces should probably take to heart. This kind of article is much loved by writers in the field of restaurants, particularly recognizable ones like Richmond, whose lives are no doubt made easier in their daily rounds once their likes and dislikes have been communicated to their eager-to-please victims ahead of time. Under Commandment 19, Richmond lists, show us the chef. Quote, if dinner for two is costing $200, you have every right to expect the chef to be at work. Restaurants where the famous celebrity chef has taken the night off should post a notice, similar to the one seen in Broadway theaters. The role of our highly publicized head chef will be played tonight by sous chef Willie Norkin, who took one semester of home economics and can't cook, unquote. As an example of lazy, disingenuous food journalism, one could scarcely hope for a better example. And this kind of cheap populism is particularly galling coming from Richmond, because he knows better. If anyone knows the chef is not in, is not likely to be in, and can't reasonably be expected to be in anytime soon, it's Richmond. He doesn't live and work in a vacuum. He doesn't write from a cork-lined room. Like others of his ilk, he moves in a demimonde of writers, journalists, bloggers, foodies, freeloaders, and publicists, all of whom know each other by sight, a large, ever-migrating school of fish involved to one degree or another in a symbiotic relationship with chefs. For years, he has observed his subjects being shaken down by every charity, foundation, professional association, civic booster, and magazine symposium, as well as by some of his colleagues. Many times, no doubt, they have complained to him, off the record, directly. Countless times, I'm sure, Richmond has gazed wearily across the latest Fiji Water-sponsored chef clusterfuck over the same tuna tartare hors d'oeuvres provided by some poor chef who's been squeezed in a service by whatever the concern of the moment is, seeing the chef or chefs dutifully doing their dog and pony act. He also well understands, one would think, the economics of maintaining the kinds of operations he's talking about. Yet he demands and expects us to believe that every time a table of customers plunks down $200 at one of Bobby Flay's restaurants, that Bobby himself should rush on over to personally wrap their tamales, and then maybe swing by, give them a little FaceTime over dessert. Thomas Keller, according to Richmond's thesis, should be burning up the air miles commuting between coasts for every service at the French Laundry and Per Se, particularly if Richmond is in the house. The whole suggestion is predicated on a damnable fucking lie. The big lie, actually, one which Richmond himself happily helped create and which he works hard on a daily basis to keep alive. See, it makes for a better article when you associate the food with a personality. Richmond, along with the best and worst of his peers, built up these names, helped make them celebrities by promoting the illusion that they cook, that if you walk into one of dozens of Jean-Georges restaurants, he's somehow back there on the line, personally sweating over your halibut, measuring freshly chopped herbs between thumb and forefinger. Every time someone writes, Mr. Batali is fond of strong, assertive flavors, however true that might be, or Jean-Georges has a way with herbs and implies or suggests that it was Mr. Batali or Mr. Van Richten who actually cooked the dish, it ignores the reality, if not the whole history, of command and control and the creative process in restaurant kitchens. While helpful to chefs on the one hand in that the big lie builds interests and helps create an identifiable brand, it also denies the truth of what is great about them, that there are plenty of great cooks in this world, but not that many great chefs. The word chef means chief. A chef is simply a cook who leads other cooks. That quality, leadership, the ability to successfully command, inspire, and delegate work to others, is the very essence of what chefs are about, as Richmond knows. But it makes better reading and easier writing to first propagate a lie, then later react with entirely feigned outrage at the reality. Underlying Richmond's argument, one suspects, is his real exasperation. Who are these grubby little cooks to dare open more restaurants? How could they be so presumptuous as to try and move up and beyond their stations? Surely it is the writers of sentences, the storytellers, so close to poets, upon whom praise and riches and clandestine blowjobs should be lavished. Not these brutish, unwashed, and undereducated men whose names are known only because he, Richmond, once deigned to write them down. The line about sous chef Willie Norkin, who took one semester of home economics and can't cook, while entertaining from an ignoramus, is unpardonable coming from Richmond. The whole system of fine dining, the whole brigade system, since Escoffier's time, is designed so that the chef might have a day off. The French Laundry, Per Se, any top-flight restaurant's whole command and training organization is built around the ideal of consistency, the necessity for the food and service to be exactly the same every time, whether the chef, famous or otherwise, is in or out. Richman knows full well that the chef, by the time his name is well known enough to profitably write about, is more likely to be in the full reclining position on a Cathay Pacific flight to Shanghai than in the kitchen when Richman next parks his wrinkled haunches into a chair in said chef's dining room. In any great restaurant, the food is going to be just as good without the chef as with. Otherwise, it wouldn't be great in the first place. Richman's commandment number 19 is a fucking insult to the very people who've been cooking and creating dishes for him for years. What's worse is that once again, this uniquely gas-engorged douche knows better. But rest assured that while he has no problem giving this stiff middle finger to the people who actually prepare his food, he will be sure to remain in good odor with the celebrity chefs he claims, on our behalf no doubt, to be outraged by. He needs that access, you see. He likes the little kitchen tours, the advanced looks at next season's menus, the friends and family invites to restaurants that have yet to open to the public, the occasional scrap of strategically leaked gossip, the free hors d'oeuvres, the swag bags, the extra courses, the attention, the flattering ministrations of the few remaining chefs who still pretend that what Alan Richman writes is in any way relevant. Not to single out Richman. Using his position as a critic to settle personal hash puts him in the same self-interested swamp as those of his peers who use their power for personal gain. Take John Mariani, the professional junketeer over at Esquire, whose likes and dislikes, shower cap in his comped hotel, attractive waitresses, car service, are mysteriously communicated as if telepathically to chefs before his arrival. Motherfucker hands out pre-printed recipe cards on arrival with instructions on how to prepare his cocktail of choice, a daiquiri. This guy's been a schnorrer for decades. He's been caught red-handed on numerous occasions, but his employers continue to dissemble on his behalf. What his editors fail to understand is that all the denials in the world don't change what everybody, and I mean everybody, in the restaurant business knows. Among his subjects, people don't wonder about this guy and whether he's bent or not. They know. Simply stated, this allows savvy restaurants in Cleveland or Chicago to essentially buy a good review and national coverage. Just don't blow the gaff, as Chef Omaro Cantu found out to his displeasure. It'll only fuck things up for everybody. After Cantu complained publicly of the way he had been treated by Mariani, making mention of the legendary wish list that preceded his arrival, Esquire editors made assurances that Mr. Mariani is directly responsible for no such list, but artfully avoided the fact that a list most surely emanates from someone associated with him. A PR firm, perhaps? But then the same delicate parsing of words is employed when Mariani is described as always paying for the meals that he reviews, leaving to dangle the question of who pays for all the other meals, his transportation, lodging, and shower caps. Over at the financial magazine Crain's, longtime reviewer Bob Lape is known to one and all in the industry as SpongeBob. It was not a term of endearment. He earned it, with hijinks like jacking up friendly chefs to provide food for his wedding. On the subject of the critic referred to as Sergeant Pepper, I'll abstain. Let her go gentle into that good night. Like Richman, she did good work in her day. Maybe it helped to buy the boyfriend's pictures, maybe not. Maybe all of Jerry Kretschmer's restaurants really were that good. She was always, to her credit, an enthusiast first. Richman, unlike many of his peers, generally knows what he's talking about. As a writer, he has all God's gifts, experience, knowledge of subject matter, a vocabulary, and the ability to put words together in entertaining and incisive fashion. Unlike the grifters, freeloaders, and pushovers who make up the majority of the food and dining press, Richman's is a discerning palate. But dumping on a place because you have a personal beef with the chef, past, present, or otherwise? Hell, the Times would fire your ass for that, or at least promote you to the T section. In the film Sexy Beast, Sir Ben Kingsley's terrifyingly believable English gangster character frequently uses a pejorative common to the British Isles, a term that Americans must circumspectly refer to as the C-word. The English and Irish bandy it about often, as in their manner of usage, and in their context, it does not refer hatefully or disparagingly to a part of the female anatomy. On the contrary, it is an unflattering, even sometimes an affectionately unflattering noun describing a male person, often used in conjunction with the adjective silly. It implies someone slightly more odious than a twit, older and more substantial than a shithead, yet without the gravitas required to be called an asshole. So, maybe I got it wrong. Alan Richman is not a douchebag. He's a cunt. Chapter 15. I Lost on Top Chef. Eric Hopfinger, 38, 20 years in the business, stood in front of the pass, a stack of dupes in his right hand, expediting to his cooks. It was Sunday morning in San Francisco's Marina District, and Circa Restaurant was full up with brunchers. The bar was crowded with them, sucking down all-you-can-drink mimosas. He'd made a tactical error putting the Benedict Sampler on the menu, he realized. Though wildly popular and a successful exercise in marketing, the dish had quickly become his nemesis. Customers could choose two of six different Eggs Benny preparations per order, allowing for over 20 different combinations of poached egg varietals and interchangeable components. The outcome was predictable. A simple foretop led easily to a dupe as long as your fucking arm. By the time the customer at position one had finished pairing the Nova Benedict with a Mexi Benedict and substituted tenderloin from the Béarnaise for the chorizo and then swapped out regular hollandaise for the saffron hollandaise and asked for the eggs well done, and the doofus across the table at position three has done the same but different, well, multiply this times four at one table and extrapolate for the whole main floor dining room and mezzanine, and you've got yourself the kind of morning that any cook who's ever worked a busy Saturday night shift and followed that with an injudicious number of Fernet Branca and ginger ale shots hates and fears in their bones. The rest of the brunch menu was filled with slightly tweaked conventional wisdom classics, a savvy but unimaginative variation on the standard document that experience tells you you absolutely need in order to fill your restaurant on a Sunday morning and afternoon. In addition to the obligatory eggs, there was a club sandwich of turkey and avocado, an equally inevitable veggie club, skewers of tomato and mozzarella, French toast, roast beef hash, huevos rancheros, and sliders, albeit with black truffle and brie. And there was fried calamari and a lobster mac and cheese and a fruit platter and the tragically inescapable classic Caesar salad, the addition of chicken to the Caesar being, of course, an option. It says something about a person when you put chicken Caesar on the menu. You've crossed a line, and you know it. It's the chef version of sucking Ron Jeremy's cock. If you do it late in your career, any notions of future stardom are usually pretty much out the window. But Eric Hopfinger was already a star. Arms crossed front and center of a group of shorter, less menacing-looking chefs, his giant-sized, bald, bullet-headed, heavily pierced and tattooed image glowered at the world from buses, billboards, and the pages of glossy magazines everywhere. His was the principal face of season four of Top Chef, the best and most watched of the competitive cooking shows. Of the contestants, Eric had obviously been designated the badass. He was older, more experienced, in years anyway, and with an imposing, if not threateningly transgressive, look. So much, one would imagine, had been expected of him on the show. You could tell that from how they'd photographed him for the posters, like the lead singer of a band or a top-billed professional wrestler. In fact, Eric looks like a bit of both. The producers, I think it is safe to suppose, anticipated much drama from Chef Hopfinger over the course of a long and closely contested competition. Unhappily for everybody, he barely made it through episode one. I know this because I was a judge on that episode. And he got sent home from the field of battle by episode three. Today, though, he was still famous, and at the very least, among friends. In between the smart-looking couples at the large oblong bar, heavily inked young men drank in groups of two and three. Fellow cooks. The home team. You could tell the cooks from the civilians by what they drank. Civilians drank the free mimosas. The industry types were deep into the Fernet shots. Somewhere in the dining room were Eric's best friend, his girlfriend, and his mom. He was getting paid good money for a five-day work week, almost unheard of in the industry, and dinner service ended at the unbelievably early hour of 10 p.m., so Circa could make the changeover to its principal business, which was the club lounge thing. "I couldn't get into auto mechanics," he said later at the bar across the street, a pint of beer in his hand, watching the dust motes float over the beer taps in the late afternoon light. He fell into a vocational cooking class instead. Perhaps now is the time to picture him. An imposingly tall, wide, barrel-chested guy. Silver hoop earrings in both ears, multiple rings, the goatee, the tats. He cultivates a shave-headed, piratical look. But what doesn't come across in the photos is his sweetness. The voice doesn't really fit the appearance. His eyes dart away from you when he talks. He seems shy. From within the hulking body and the designed to intimidate look, half pirate, half Aryan brother, there's a vibe of a scared and damaged little boy, someone who might burst into tears at any moment. Which is to say, he's a very likable guy. You want, shortly after meeting him, to give him a big hug. At 17, he answered an ad in the local Penny Saver and began washing dishes at the Chateau Continental in Briarcliff, New York. It was a two-man kitchen, he said. Ugly Albanian dudes. They did about 40 depressing covers a night, a mixed bag of delusionally transatlantic fare like Greek salad, beef bourguignon, and stuffed veal chop. He washed dishes, scrubbed pots, peeled potatoes, and did general scut work there for a year and a half, before decamping for greener fields and more elevated social status at TGI Fridays in Tarrytown. I started getting laid at Fridays, he said, by way of explanation. He made $11 an hour, worked the grill station, drank for free, and by age 18 had been rewarded for his high standards of burgerdom with a promotion to what would appear on later resumes alternately as sous chef and kitchen manager. Around this time, he fell into the professional orbit of friend and hockey buddy, Scott. Scott was living a relatively high life over at Huckleberry's in Yorktown, which put even the sybaritic delights of TGI Fridays to shame. He had a cool car and hot chicks, Eric remembered, an observation that led him to abandon Fridays for his friend's kitchen. He enthusiastically took the less prestigious but presumably more rewarding position of fry monkey at Huckleberry's. Asked to remember the menu, he foggily recalls chicken pot pie, shepherd's pie, and tempura. With somewhat more clarity, he recalls being fired twice during the year and a half he worked there, and that he, quote, fucked the whole staff, unquote. Young Eric was now 20 years old. Examining the murk of his resume, one would likely find one of those mysteriously soft gray spots all too common to cooks of his generation and mine. What was actually a year-long hiatus as a landscaper disappears, no doubt, in between the happy days of wine and frolic at Huckleberry's and his next restaurant gig at the That-Away Cafe in Greenwich, Connecticut. Departure date at Huckleberry's moved forward a bit. Start day at That-Away pulled back. In my case, whole years disappear in this way. One's younger years now a seamless record of full, and as important, steady, employment. Or depending on who's going to be looking at your resume, TGI Fridays or That-Away Cafe can be replaced by, quote, traveling in France, unquote. Unless, like Eric, you spend 3 years at the That-Away, drinking and snorting and cooking an unchallenging menu of burgers, chicken sandwiches, and flank steaks. Sometime in the early 90s, the exact dates being characteristically hazy, Eric Hopfinger answered an ad and found himself working the pantry and grill stations at Eros on First Avenue in Manhattan. He describes it as the first good restaurant he'd ever worked in. The chef had worked at the Quilted Giraffe, a still important restaurant. They made their own charcuterie, roasted fish whole on the bone, and grilled fresh sardines. Small things, one would think now, but relatively advanced thinking back then, and definitely a big deal for Eric. Nearly 2 decades later, he puts down his pint glass with a 5-mile stare and remembers. It's the first time since we started talking that he seems genuinely excited talking about food. Eros was super new. I'd never worked in the city and was totally overwhelmed with the spices, the brines, the butchering, and the city itself. I think I took the challenge balls to the wall, you know, putting in my first real shifts, arriving at 2 p.m. and working till 2 a.m. I never asked so many questions in my life. But soon after this, you bugged out for fucking California, I challenge him. You're learning stuff. It's just started getting tough. The first good food you've cooked in your life. Okay, maybe it's not the majors yet, but at least you've got a foot on the fucking ladder. And then you're gone? You screw the pooch for California? Why? Scott, he answers, as if that explained everything. When I left for San Francisco, I felt a little shitty, but I was determined to be a chef and thought by being a New Yorker I'd have a leg up on all those laid-back Cali dudes, he added in a statement I found unconvincing. The more likely explanation is simply that his bestest buddy was in San Francisco and said he should come out and that it was fun. So he did. What is a reasonably certain matter of record is that Eric Hopfinger arrived in San Francisco in 1996 and became the sous chef at City Tavern. Not too long after, when the chef didn't show up on a Friday night, he says, he found himself in charge. 2 years later, he was the chef at Backflip, a hipster bar in a retro-cool motel in the Tenderloin District, where he started to get some attention. A nod for best bar food from the San Francisco Chronicle, and where he began to establish a career pattern of working fairly high-profile places that were as much bars or lounges as they were restaurants. It's also, and I'm guessing this on the basis of almost nothing, where he started to learn how to hustle, how to manage expectations, work the press, shape the beginnings of a public image of sorts. Then there was Butterfly, a more ambitious venture in Asian fusion and also a big bar scene, which is where I met him for the first time, an occasion I describe synonymously in A Cook's Tour. I remember him in 2001 with hair, blonde at the time, I think, comping me and my crew a meal and then inviting me back into his kitchen, where he unburdened himself of some staffing problems he was having. I believe I advised him to fire his sous chef. Was it Scott? My recollection is that he appeared to agree with my suggested course of action before offering me a bump. I saw him again a year or so later at the House of Prime Rib. We got pretty drunk together and ate a lot of beef. After Butterfly, there was something called Spoon. He alludes to a brief spell in a Mexican jail. The name Scott appears again in this episode. Then Cosmo's Corner Grill before finally landing at Circa. I hadn't heard anything more from him or about him until the producers of Top Chef called. Since I was an occasional guest judge, they wanted to know how well I knew this guy Hopfinger, as I would likely be facing him across the table in the coming season. They wanted to know if I could exercise my critical duties without any personal considerations coming into play. I assured them that I could. According to Eric, he'd attracted the notice of the Top Chef casting people at a Battle of the Chefs event held at a department store, one of those silly promotional clusterfucks much loved by restaurant publicists, as it makes them look like they're actually doing something. The chef gets to bust his ass giving away a lot of free food, and presumably the masses, having noticed his fine work, form a herd and gang rush his restaurant. Usually this kind of thing attracts a bunch of freeloading types, the kind of people who hang around department stores for free food, or because they have nothing better to do, are very rarely the kind of customer to come into your restaurant with friends and spend profligately on wine. But in this case, says Eric, it attracted two television producers. Quote, one dude was kind of geeky, the other was a hot blonde. It was their first Fernet experience. Unquote. Curiously, he never had to cook for them. They wanted to know, what do you think of Tom Colicchio? Correct answer, I see him as the walking Buddha of chefdom. What are your passions? Correct answer, cooking and being a character with a good backstory prone to dramatic confrontation with fellow contestants. After he was told he'd made the cut, he went to the Horseshoe and got loaded, dreaming of his future fame. Not too long after, Eric Hopfinger found himself boarded up and under guard with 15 other contestants at an undisclosed location in Chicago, deprived of television, internet, unsupervised telephone calls, and subject to a secrecy agreement so draconian as to be the envy of the NSA. Now, I haven't read my copy of this agreement, but I seem to remember the figure million mentioned along with dollars and vows of absolute confidentiality. And I'm guessing that both Eric and I are still somehow constrained from talking about specifics of security, any onset instances of the use of controlled substances, which judges might or might not be smarter than the others, whether or not there are tumblers of gin and tonic under the judge's table, and so on. To speculate on such things would be irresponsible. What I can assure you without hesitation or qualification is that the judging I've been witness to or part of in 5 appearances as a judge has always been straight. Meaning, no matter how much the producers of the show may want the contestant with the heartbreakingly tragic personal story and amazing chesticles to survive until next week, the worst cook that particular week goes home. On Top Chef, as long as Tom Colicchio is head judge, the best food that week gets you the win. The worst gets you the loss. It's the what have you done for me lately criterion at judge's table. due to the fact that guest judges can't and haven't been witness to a contestant's previous efforts, past works do not factor into the final judgment. I feel sorry for the producers sometimes, imagining their silent screams as Tom reluctantly decides that the all-around better contestant with the movie star looks and the huge popularity with viewers just fucked up too bad to make it to next week and has to go home. Their lips mouthing, "No, not Trey, not Trey," impotently in the control room as another beloved fan favorite gets sent packing. Judging is taken seriously by the permanent judges and guest judges alike. I've spent hours arguing with Tom, Padma, and guest judges trying to reach a consensus on winners and losers. It is a thoughtful and considered process. What should be stressed here is that what the contestants on Top Chef are asked to do is really, really difficult. Confined to quarters with strangers, separated from family and friends, they are asked to execute on short notice a bizarre progression of cooking challenges without benefit of recipes or cookbooks. Anything from create a snack from this crap vending machine to make a traditional Hawaiian meal with unfamiliar ingredients to create a four-course high-end menu for Eric Repair and do it in the rain over portable field ranges. The rigors of Top Chef's unpredictable, high-pressure, occasionally loony product placement-driven challenges, be sure to use X-brand frozen pasta dinners in your final dish, would be brutal for any seasoned professional. I will tell you honestly that if I were a contestant, I might, maybe, if I was lucky and only through a combination of years of experience, stealth, strategy, and guile, duck and dodge my way through a few weeks. I'd never make the finals. What's fascinating to a professional watching the show is how other talented professional cooks and chefs are pushed to the limits of their ability. You can actually see them hit the ceiling, the place beyond which they just aren't prepared to, just can't go. And exactly why? A failure of the imagination, a failure of technique or strategy, maturity or experience. And yet, many times, you see contestants go beyond their previous abilities. You can see them dig down or pull from left field and go higher than they've ever been before. This leads all by itself to fascinating drama for food nerds. The best chef or the best all-around talent doesn't necessarily win. The most technically skilled cook or the most creative often overreaches, chokes, makes a crucial and inexplicable error of judgment, just like real life. That's what makes the show worth watching, to me anyway. That the chef left standing after all others have fallen represents the qualities you'd want of a chef in the real world. A combination of creativity, technical skill, leadership abilities, flexibility, maturity, grace under pressure, sense of humor, and sheer strength and endurance. Eric Hopfinger came one thin hair away from getting snuffed right out of the box. I was guest judge along with Rocco DeSpirito and regulars Padma and Tom. The challenge was to recreate one of a list of mid-range restaurant cliche classics like shrimp scampi, lasagna, steak au poivre, and duck à l'orange. The contestants drew knives to determine who got what. Eric got the souffle. Now, a souffle can be a tricky thing under the best of circumstances. Most cooks learn to make them in school, and unless they move on to become pastry chefs, are seldom called on to make them again, ever. Because of their delicacy and time concerns, and because they just haven't been in fashion, you rarely see a souffle of any kind in a restaurant these days, which means very few cooks, if suddenly called upon to make one without a recipe, could do so. Hell, even with a recipe, I guess the greater part of the cooking population would fuck the job up. Me? Maybe. And that's only because I spent 6 months doing almost nothing but making souffles at the Rainbow Room early in my career. And they were a pretty leathery, unimpressive version made from cement-like bechamel, cheap flavorings, and meringue. Even if you do everything right before you get your souffle in the oven, there's still a whole lot of ways to fuck up. Pull it out too soon, it deflates by service. Too late, it burns and hollows. Slam the oven door, forget to correctly grease and sugar the mold, thermostat fucked, uneven heat in the oven. Or will the thing just sit too long while they reset the cameras or apply powder to a shiny judge? The souffle is fraught with peril. And in a competitive high-pressure situation like Top Chef, or even shit you know how to do in your bones, can suddenly sense fear and go south on you, well, a souffle is a death sentence. From the relative comfort of my judge's chair, a freshly poured gin close at hand, I saw Eric draw the souffle and knew the poor bastard had walked right into the grinder. He looked like he'd been punched in the stomach before he even started cooking. In retrospect, he says now, Top Chef looks a lot easier sitting on the couch with a joint in your mouth. What he came up with was a souffle only in the most liberal interpretation of the word. It did come in a souffle mold, intended, I could only guess, as an airier version of cornbread or corn pudding. But like a dog trying to cover its shit with leaves or dirt, Eric had literally piled on every trick or trope in the Fomex Southwestern cookbook. The plate looked like the last shot of a bukkake video filmed at Chili's. It was some kind of awful avocado jizz squirted all over the plate, some other squeeze-bottled madness, and worst of all, the souffle itself had been buried under a fried garnish, either crushing the fucking thing or ineptly concealing the fact that it had never risen in the first place. Looking down with no small amount of sadness at what he'd put in front of me, I could only compare it to the work of a first-time serial killer, hurriedly and inadequately trying to dispose of his victim under twigs and brush, inevitably to be discovered by the first passing dog walker. What saved him that week was another contestant's shrimp scampi. While Eric had thoroughly fucked up a hard task, she'd managed to make a hideous botch of a very simple one. Her twist on scampi involved three very basic, very simple elements, all of which she'd botched indefensibly. The shrimp was overcooked, the accompanying flan had curdled into an unappetizing smegma-like substance, and she'd criminally oversalted the dish. As happened sometime on the show, someone who failed utterly was saved solely by the fact that someone else sucked worse. 2 weeks later, the axe fell. He was sent home over a soggy corn dog. Did you ever belong on the show in the first place? I asked him. Nah, I knew it all along. He stopped watching the show after he was thrown off. Was he ever scared? What scares me, he says, is growing up, having kids. I'm deathly afraid of having kids. Probably because I am a big kid. He drains his beer, examines the empty pint glass thoughtfully, and offers, but that would probably make me a good father. I love Disneyland, the whole pirate thing. I love Disneyland. That makes me want to procreate. Of his Top Chef experience, he has no complaints. They didn't turn me into something I wasn't. And of his life and career in general, the good, the bad, I'm pretty happy with the way I've done things where I'm at. I'm going down a good path. The quality of life is good, hanging out, my friends, eating great food. Look, he says, I love cooking food. I'm not pressing any culinary envelopes, I know that. There's a few sick fuckers like us who are actually meant to do this.